Welcome to Food for Thought. My name is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau from Compassionate Cooks. I founded Compassionate Cooks to empower people to make informed food choices and to debunk myths about vegetarianism and animal rights. You can learn more about who we are and what we do by visiting our website, CompassionateCooks.com, or the website of our new cookbook, JoyOfVeganBaking.com. Hello, everybody. My first piece of advice to you is to never record a podcast episode without plugging in the computer first. I thought I'd have enough life on the battery, and unfortunately, I lost the entire podcast episode that I recorded already, so this is the second time I'm recording this episode. Yeah, so lesson learned. Won't do that again. So, good to be here with you. I apologize for skipping a week. I have been pretty busy, and I was really anxious to record this episode today, which is why it's such a bummer that I lost all that work, because I had to literally drag myself inside from outside, because it's like perfect day today. It's just perfect weather. We get a lot of perfect days here in Northern California, but today's like exceptionally perfect. Anyway, moving on. First, I'd like to thank our sponsor. The sponsor for today's podcast is Joseph Reese, who I had the pleasure of meeting in Washington, D.C. when I was speaking there a few months ago, and he wrote me such a lovely email, which I would like to share with you now. He wrote, "It would be inappropriate for me to start my email with anything but thanks, so thank you. While I found your podcast and later your website as a vegan, it has kept me strong, informed, and motivated in the turmoil of high school. By being part of my routine through your podcast, you have enabled me to constantly remind myself of what I consider my life's mission despite its constant subjugation at the omnipotent weight of popular acceptance. I'm able to transmit this empowerment to my work through the American University Animal Rights Effort, AURE, AWARE, it sounds like, with a U. And I imagine this is a group that Joseph either started or is part of at the American University. But best of all, I have seen your podcast act as a catalyst of truth for the awakening of some of the people I hold closest to my heart. My sister, once an ovo-lacto vegetarian and now a vegan, and my best friend, once an unapologetic in-your-face omnivore, now a vegan. Both of these transitions were solidified simply through my suggestion of your podcast to them. And to some degree, it means your podcast has facilitated the building of my support in both the most immense joy and terrible sorrow I'm sure you know come from a vegan lifestyle. So thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Joseph. Thank you for all that you do and for your support. And I encourage you to keep up the fantastic work. And thank you so much for being a voice for the animals. And to Joseph's best friend and sister, I commend you highly for being open to Joseph's suggestion. And I wish you all the best. Admittedly, I am having a hard time keeping up with the podcast as a weekly program, but I am doing the best I can. It's a lot of work, and your support, your sponsorships help more than you know. And I really thank you for all of your support. Some people, and perhaps you might consider this, ask for a podcast sponsorship for the holidays or for their birthday, and I thought I would suggest that to all of you. So if people ask you what you want for your birthday or for the holidays coming up, you can say that you'd like a podcast sponsorship. It's just a thought, but just know that I am very grateful for your support, and I am dedicated to all of you and to the animals who need our help so desperately. If you would like to sponsor this podcast, please visit CompassionateCooks.com and click on support the podcast. Thank you very much. And also, if you're interested, now that the book is out, Joy of Vegan Baking, now that the book is out, I encourage you to visit websites, stores like Amazon.com and Powell's.com and BarnesandNoble.com, and write a review of the book. Whether you've cooked anything from the book or not, you can still write a review. The book is made up of a lot more than just recipes, so you can certainly have an opinion about the book even before you bake anything from it. But also, if you have a blog, or if you visit other people's blogs, or if you have a website or a MySpace page or a podcast or any other way you can help spread the word, I would really appreciate it. You can leave a comment, preferably a favorable one, and just help spread the word about the book. And again, visit joyofveganbaking.com for other things that you can do. So I appreciate it. So I'm very excited about today's topic. I've been wanting to do this topic for a long time, and it is quite daunting. And because it is daunting and so huge, I will actually break it up into several parts and just continue doing it over the course of time. I've been threatening to do this topic for over a year now, and I hope you appreciate it as much as I do. I hope you appreciate the topic itself as much as I do. So what I want to do is examine how our use of language denigrates animals and contributes to our violence against them. And if you're skeptical about the idea that our use of words and our use of language could actually contribute to violence against anybody, I just encourage you to stick around and hear what I have to say about it. Through our use of animal-based idioms and proverbs, we commit violence against animals without even realizing it, without even thinking about it, without even being aware of it. Or perhaps if we are aware, we just think that our use of certain words or phrases are innocuous, or we just think of our use of words and phrases as harmless or neutral. But I disagree, and I disagree vehemently. A culture's language reflects the values of that society, and our shared use of that language reflects our agreement with those values. So by changing our language, by choosing words that reflect compassion and nonviolence, we begin to reflect new values, and we begin to spread these values to other segments of the society. The phrases and expressions we use today have been passed down from many, many years ago. In some cases, they come from ancient cultures, and we perpetuate the speciesist values of these old cultures, as well as our current culture, when we keep these idioms and expressions alive. Now, an idiom, as I'm sure you know or remember, is a combination of words that, when put together, has a meaning that's different from the meanings of the individual words themselves. It can have a literal meaning in one situation and a different idiomatic meaning in another situation. It's a phrase which does not always follow the normal rules of meaning and grammar, which makes idioms difficult to understand when you're learning a new language. And almost every culture, almost every language has idioms. Some idioms are more universal than others, and they can be easily translated, but some of them cannot be translated literally. Idioms tend to be very localized, only relevant to a particular region, and not useful for communication outside of that local context. And though I think that most of my listeners will be familiar with the idioms I'm going to mention, I'm aware that some of them will be unfamiliar to you, but I think you'll get the point. And I encourage you to take a look at the idioms in your own culture or your own native language and see where some might be better put to rest for good and replaced with compassionate versions. So an example of an American idiom is to sit on the fence, right? Translated literally, it means to sit on a fence. But the idiomatic meaning of to sit on the fence is to have difficulty making a clear choice regarding some issue, as in the meat eater sat on the fence about becoming vegan. Okay. There are obviously thousands more idioms. A typical English idiom dictionary lists over 4,000 idioms. And interestingly enough, it's estimated that William Shakespeare coined over 2,000 of these idioms, 2,000 idioms that are still in use today. And if I haven't confessed it yet, I am a total Shakespeare geek. I say unabashedly, in undergrad and grad school, Shakespeare, as well as medieval literature, such as Chaucer, was my focus. And Shakespeare's contribution to English literature and language never ceases to amaze me. It's just amazing how he was able to just coin words and phrases, or just put certain words in a certain order and create the most fantastic expressions. So anyway, I'm a total Shakespeare geek, and we have him to thank for a lot of the expressions that we're still using today. In many ways, idioms define a culture and help non-native speakers discern habits and traditions of that culture. And as I've indicated already, many of our idioms reflect and contribute to our speciesist perception and violent treatment of non-human animals. In addition to the idioms we use, there are also proverbs that do the same thing, reflect the role and position of non-human animals in our society. And I'd like to include proverbs in our discussion as well. And just to be clear, proverbs are different than idioms. A proverb is a short saying that's generally known and used by many people. The saying usually contains words of wisdom or words of truth or morals that are based on common sense or practical experience. A proverb is often a description of a basic rule of conduct that all people generally follow or should follow. Proverbs can be found in all languages. Examples of proverbs include money doesn't grow on trees, which means money is not easy to get and you must work for it. Or another proverb is the pen is mightier than the sword, which means that writing and ideas are more powerful than the use of force. And there are hundreds and hundreds more proverbs. So what I'd like to do today is explore some of the more commonly used idioms and proverbs that we use in our everyday speech, take a look at their origins, and offer some compassionate versions that can replace the more violent, more offensive ones. When you take a look at the idioms and proverbs that we use without thinking, even those of us who are aware, you know, even those of us who consider ourselves animal activists or non-speciesists, we use these proverbs without thinking, and it's just amazing to note how violent our speech is. Just listen to some of these common idioms, and this list is not even comprehensive. I'm going to go through this pretty quickly just to give you an idea, but we will spend some time on some of these proverbs and idioms in our episode today. One man's meat is another man's poison. To pig out, in a pig's eye, sweat like a pig, bleed like a stuck pig, piggyback, road hog, fat as a hog, to go hog wild, hogwash, go the whole hog, eat high on the hog, pig in a poke, cast pearls before swine, make a silk purse out of a sow's ear, to be bullheaded, to shoot the bull, to take the bull by the horns, to kill the fatted calf, cash cow, big enough to choke a cow. Why buy a cow when you can get the milk for free? Dirty rat, rat race, rat fink, to smell a rat. Dead as a dodo, kill two birds with one stone. Lame duck, dead duck, a sitting duck, ugly duckling. Pigeon toad, a bird in hand is worth two in the bush. Run around like a chicken with his head cut off. Odd bird, bet on a lame rooster. A chicken in every pot, don't count your chickens before they're hatched. Cook one's goose, kill not the goose that lays the golden egg. Easy as duck soup, on a wild goose chase, to eat crow. To have an albatross hanging around one's neck, to put all your eggs in one basket, to put a feather in your cap, to get all your ducks in a row, to stone the crows, to clip someone's wings, to chicken out, to get someone's goat, scapegoat, black sheep, separate the sheep from the goats, like a lamb to slaughter, mutton dressed as lamb, a wolf in sheep's clothing, every dog has his day, to treat someone like a dog and pony show, mean as a junkyard dog, to work like a dog, dog-faced liar, to be in the doghouse, to throw someone a bone, a dog-eat-dog world, he who lies with dogs rises with fleas, something's fishy, it's easy as shooting fish in a barrel, to have other fish to fry, to fish or cut bait, monkey business, monkey suit, monkey see, monkey do, to have a monkey on one's back, funny as a barrel of monkeys, to bug someone, crazy as a June bug, snake in the grass, mean as a snake, stubborn as a mule, straight from the horse's mouth, to be a dark horse. Don't lick a gift horse in the mouth. It's no use beating a dead horse. Don't put the cart before the horse. To eat like a horse. Hold your horses. Chomp at the bit. Don't look a gift horse in the mouth. Scaredy cat, fraidy cat, more than one way to skin a cat, no room to swing a cat, let the cat out of the bag, turn tail, kangaroo court, sly as a fox, keep on a short leash, packed in like sardines, open a can of worms, go ape, as gruff as a bear, to throw someone to the wolves, to be mad as a March hare, crazy like a fox, have a tiger by the tail, weasel out of something, pull the wool over someone's eyes, the straw that broke the camel's back. This list goes on and on. You see why it has to be broken up now, and you can see why it has to be broken up into several parts. And I'm only going to cover a handful today. Now, it's not like there aren't kinder or even neutral metaphors in our speech. We do say things like purr like a cat, or the cat's meow, or busy as a bee, swan song, birds of a feather flock together, and other ones that aren't necessarily negative, that aren't necessarily violent towards animals, that are actually positive towards animals or like I said, just neutral. But there are certainly a lot more negative ones than there are positive ones. And these more positive ones don't have the effect on our psyches that the negative ones do. That is to say, when we use the positive ones, that doesn't necessarily reflect an overwhelming amount of compassion that we show towards these animals as much as the use of the negative ones reflecting an overwhelming amount of violence towards animals in our society. Now, in one way or another, the idioms and proverbs I just read in that long list, in one way or another, reflect and reinforce our use of or abuse of animals in our society. So I'm not just talking about our violence against animals, things like, you know, to kill two birds with one stone is pretty violent, actually, to skin, you know, more than one way to skin a cat. But there are other ones like, you know, to put the cart before the horse. It doesn't necessarily reflect abuse of animals, but it does reflect the use and exploitation of animals in our society. So I am going to include those as well and offer compassionate versions of those. We'll take a few apart in today's episode and we'll return again and again until we exhaust this list and find new ways to express ourselves that reflect not exploitation and violence, but rather respect and compassion and empathy and kindness and truth. One of the precepts in Buddhism is the precept of right speech. Right speech is one of the elements of the Noble Eightfold Path. And the Noble Eightfold Path, by the way, is in the teachings of the Buddha, a practical guide for living that leads to the end of suffering, is what it means to follow the Noble Eightfold Path. And right speech is one of the elements of this path. And right speech falls under the category of ethical conducts, along with right action and right livelihood. The importance of speech in the context of Buddhist ethics is profound. Words can break or save lives, make enemies or friends, start war or create peace. Buddha explained right speech as follows. 1. To abstain from false speech, especially not to tell deliberate lies and not to speak deceitfully. 2. To abstain from slanderous speech and not to use words maliciously against others. 3. To abstain from harsh words that offend or hurt others. And 4. To abstain from idle chatter that lacks purpose or depth. Positively phrased, this means to tell the truth, to speak friendly, warm, and gently, and to talk only when necessary. And I just think that's so lovely. And I also appreciate the difficulty many of us have if we try to attain this ideal. But I always think of this teaching. I always think of the concept of right speech when I talk about the importance of using language that reflects not only truth, but also nonviolence. So that is the context in which I encourage everyone to just be aware of the language we use and be aware that we do use language that reflects hatred and violence and superiority, racism, speciesism, and so on. And the language reflects our hatred and our violence and our superiority, our racism, speciesism, and so on. Our liberation from our violence towards animals, you understand that I believe abstaining from violence towards animals and each other actually means our own liberation. Okay, you understand that I mean that. Our liberation from our violence towards, so it not only liberates them, but it liberates us as well. Our liberation from our violence towards animals and each other isn't going to come until we change the paradigm. I personally believe that the change will occur for animals only as we change, only as we, the ones who hold the power, change their status in society. And one of the ways we change their status is by changing our perception of them. And one of the ways we change our perception of them is by changing the way we talk about them. Now, some of the compassionate alternatives I'm going to suggest are ones that I really do use in everyday speech. But I'll admit, it was a bit of an adjustment at first. It took a few times saying them to feel comfortable with them, to make them feel natural in my mouth. So please just trust me. When you start practicing the compassionate versions of these expressions, just give it a little time and they will soon feel as natural to you as the ones you used before, okay? So just trust me. It's actually so much fun when they become your natural expressions, because you'll just be conversing with somebody and you'll slip in the, you know, compassionate version as naturally as can be, and then you'll continue talking. But the person you're talking to will be taken aback by what you just said. So even though it might interrupt the flow of your conversation, it really offers a wonderful opportunity for planting seeds, because that person becomes aware for the first time of how violent our speech is. And when people are around me, they are aware of their use of speech. It happens very naturally. It happens very organically. So if I'm with people who, again, are not very conscious about animals and animal rights, they start saying something like, kill two birds with one stone. And in my presence, they realize, wait a second, that doesn't sound so nice. And they think, oh, you know, gosh, what should I say? And so that offers the opportunity to give them an alternative and say, well, you can cut two carrots with one knife instead of kill two birds with one stone. And so that's the one I'd like to start with today. To kill two birds with one stone. The expression obviously means to achieve two objectives with a single effort, right? But it's so violent. Apparently, it's been around for a long time. Ovid, the Roman poet who lived from about 43 BC to 17 AD, used a similar expression in Latin nearly 2,000 years ago. So I think it's about time we put this one to rest. It's been here long enough. And like I said, I say cut two carrots with one knife. And it comes out as naturally for me now as kill two birds with one stone used to come out. And but even saying kill two birds with one stone sounds so horrible. I don't even like saying it. So try it. Try cut two carrots with one knife, or cut two potatoes with one knife. I don't know, whatever you want to cut with one knife. And like I said, people will stop me in mid-sentence and be like, what did you just say? It never fails to make someone think twice about the violence of the original phrase and how you can use a different phrase to say the same thing, to say what you mean without such violence. So you get it. So on our bird theme, we have expressions such as a bird in hand is worth two in the bush. And the meaning is that it's better to have a small actual advantage than the chance of a greater advantage. The earliest written form that I am aware of is in a U.S. newspaper from January 1833. And the expression was, but few persons, so prone are we to grasp at the shadow at the expense of the substance, bear in mind the good old adage, a bird in hand is worth two in the bush. Now the quote refers to the good old adage, as if to say that the adage is an old one. So it clearly existed before 1833 when this was printed, and how long before that is uncertain. But variations of this phrase have been known for centuries. The earliest version of the proverb is from the Bible and was translated into English in Wycliffe's version of the Bible in 1382, although Latin texts have it from the 13th century. In Ecclesiastes, there is a phrase that I would incidentally include in my list of species as proverbs that I didn't include it above, and that perhaps we'll address later. But the phrase is, a living dog is better than a dead lion. John Heywood, the 16th century collector of proverbs, recorded another version in his ambitiously titled A Dialogue Containing the Number and Effect of All the Proverbs in the English Tongue in 1546. Better one bird in hand than 10 in the wood. The expression refers back to medieval falconry, and the term bird in hand must have been known in the U.S. by 1734, because that is the date when a small town in Pennsylvania was founded with the same names. So obviously the expression was known in the U.S. by then. Since this expression refers to perceiving birds as prey animals, and not by predatorial animals, but by humans, and also refers to using falcons as agents of hunting, I'm not a fan of this expression, and I call for its abolition. So what are some compassionate versions? Joanne Stepaniak, in her cookbook, Vegan Vittles, offers some wonderful compassionate versions of idioms and proverbs, some of which I'll use here. And her suggestion for this proverb is, a berry in hand is worth two on the bush. So again, you know, it might seem kind of awkward to say it at first, but you practice it a few times and it becomes very natural. So a berry in hand is worth two on the bush. A berry in hand is worth two on the bush. See? Natural already. So incidentally, just wanted to share this with you. Speaking of falconry, many years ago, at a time when my eyes were not completely open, David and I were in Vermont vacationing. This is when we lived on the East Coast, and we were staying near this really beautiful hotel that offered the opportunity to attend their falconry school. They had this falconry school there. So we spent several hours with these amazing birds, but it didn't occur to us until we were halfway through that, duh, falconry is inherently linked to hunting. We were just so caught up in the idea of interacting with these amazing birds. They really were quite amazing, but of course I would never do it again, that we didn't even think about it. Falconry, or hawking, involves training raptors are birds of prey, such as hawks and falcons, to pursue the prey for humans. And we saw how they train these birds. They train them by essentially starving them. It's controlled starvation. Now, of course, the falconers, the trainers, would oppose that characterization, but that's all it is. They constantly manipulate the food and the weight of the bird so that they can get the birds just right for hunting. If they feed them too little, the birds may be too weak to hunt. If they feed them too much, they will have no interest in hunting because they won't be hungry. And then some other issues of it. There, of course, is the captive breeding process. Of course, only those who fit certain criteria are kept, and the rest are discarded. And there are also people who trap wild birds for falconing, and they train these birds. And then, of course, these birds are carnivores, so there's the very contrived preparation of meat just to feed the birds that are used to hunt other animals as sport for humans. So it was quite a learning experience for us. It was definitely one of those things that opened our eyes to animal exploitation. And I just share this with you because when we start this journey, it's not a perfect one and we really do the best we can. But as you go on this journey, you really do start to notice things that you didn't see before. And this was certainly something that opened my eyes. Another violent bird-related idiom is run around like a chicken with his head cut off. The meaning, of course, is to run around in a frenzied manner. The origin, as you can surmise, relates to birds who may sometimes run around in a frenzied state for several minutes after decapitation. This horrible phrase was known in the US by the late 19th century. It's recorded in print, as a simile from the 1880s. Obviously, there are much less violent ways to make the point. You can just say something as simple as, you know, he ran around in a frenzied state. He ran around in a frenzy. There are a number of bird-related idioms and proverbs, so I'm just going to run through a few here. If someone cooks your goose, they really annoy you. So you can say that someone really burns your cookies, which I like. It's from Vegan Vittles. So, you know, so he really burns my cookies. Some of them are more playful than others, and you can make up your own. You can send me some that you make up, which would be fun to do, but I like that one. So if someone, instead of someone cooking your goose, someone really burns your cookies. Also suggested by Vegan Vittles, instead of kill not the goose that lays the golden egg, you can try fell not the tree that yields the sweetest fruit. Now, I don't walk around saying kill not the goose that lays the golden egg, but some people might. And instead, you can offer the alternative fell not the tree that yields the sweetest fruit. It becomes natural when you say it again. Fell not the tree that yields the sweetest fruit. Okay, so try that one. If something is as easy as duck soup, you can change it to something being as easy as boiling water. That's also a suggestion in Vegan Vittles. Instead of warning someone not to put all your eggs in one basket, you can warn them not to put all your berries in a bowl, you know, because like the berries would get crushed on the bottom and they'd kind of rot on the bottom. So don't put all of your berries in one bowl. Don't put all of your berries in one bowl, okay? And when you go on a wild goose chase, you're just pursuing a fruitless search. You can say that. Don't pursue a fruitless search. But Joanne Stepaniak, which I like, suggests you're out chasing rainbows. Don't go out chasing rainbows. You know, he's out on a wild goose chase, he's out chasing rainbows. And I like that one. To eat crow is one that cries out for a compassionate version. To eat crow is to abase oneself. And you can just as easily say to eat humble pie. Some of you probably already say that now. And so that would be one that works beautifully. And no crows would have to be killed for this particular pie. There's a long story about the origins of this expression, but it's quite intricate and I don't want to bore you. So I'm just going to leave it at that and so that we don't abuse any crows. Crows are awesome. I love when the crows come. The crows come around this time of year. It's October now, and they come around this time of year and perch in this large juniper we have in our backyard, and they're just so amazing. And I absolutely adore crows. So I don't want to eat them. Another popular bird idiom is to have an albatross hanging around one's neck. You may have heard that, to have an albatross hanging around one's neck. And it refers to some unfortunate person who's forced to carry a burden. So, for you literature lovers out there, you probably know already that it comes from Samuel Taylor Coleridge's poem, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, in which the character who shot an albatross, by the way, is a bird, it's a seabird. The character who shoots the albatross is obliged to carry the bird, dead bird, hung around his neck as a reminder of this disgrace. And it goes, God save thee, ancient mariner, from the fiends that plague thee thus. Why look'st thou so? With my crossbow I shot the albatross. Ah, well a day, what evil looks had I from old and young. Instead of the cross, the albatross about my neck was hung. In the poem, an albatross starts to follow the ship, and the fact that he's following the ship is seen as a good omen. And so the sailor who shoots him is shamed by this, and his punishment is to wear the albatross around his neck as a reminder of what he did. Now, I suppose one could argue that the expression is, in a way, is kind of honoring the bird, because it's his dead body that serves as a reminder of the sailor's disgrace. But meh. From that poem, however, we can extract another saying, and many people use it already. You could say it's the cross you have to bear. This is the cross I have to bear. And of course, this refers to Christianity and the crucifixion of Jesus and the fact that he had to carry the cross upon which he would be nailed. Another idiom that could potentially work as an alternative, though the meaning is a little different, well, I'll say it anyway, is to refer to someone's Achilles heel. The legend of Achilles has it that he was dipped into the river Styx by his mother in order to make him invulnerable. And his heel was not covered by the water, because she had to hold him by his heel when she dipped him in the water. And he was later killed by an arrow wound to his heel. And the thing that's so interesting, and I think appropriate for our purposes here, is that the legend of Achilles is obviously ancient, but the phrase to have an Achilles heel wasn't picked up in English until the 19th century. And guess who coined it? It was Samuel Taylor Coleridge in The Friend, in this literary paper from 1810. And he wrote, Ireland, that vulnerable heel of the British Achilles. And that's the first time that phrase was used. But perhaps you can say, you know, cross around my neck, or burden around my neck, or weight to bear, that kind of thing. Three more bird idioms. First, the expression for the bird, something's for the birds. It refers to something that's just useless or trivial or worthless. So I'm not fond of that. I'm not fond of referring to something being worthless as being for the birds. The phrase seems to be solely used in the United States. I don't know how many people have heard of it outside the United States. Apparently, it's U.S. Army slang, and it originated towards the end of World War II. Now, I don't know if I'm going to have to mark this particular episode as explicit if I use a dirty word, because the original slang was, it wasn't, that's for the birds. The original slang, because that's just a shortened form of the original, which is, that's shite for the birds. Well, I'll use the British variant of the word. I don't think I'm going to have to mark it explicit, but instead of it's for the birds, it was that shite for the birds. And it refers to the fact that some birds peck at horse droppings in order to find seeds, right? But I don't like it. I'd rather say something's just worthless, or something's meaningless, or it's trash for the compost heap, or it's just trash for the bin, something like that. That's what I suggest. The second bird idiom, stool pigeon. To call someone a stool pigeon is to call them a police informant or a criminal's lookout. It's to call them a snitch, basically. And it has negative connotations, and I love pigeons a lot, so I don't want to perpetuate any negative thoughts about them by using this phrase. Plus, most reference sources say that this expression derives from the hunting practice of affixing a dead or replica pigeon on a stool to act as a decoy to attract other birds so you can shoot them. Hello, I'm not loving that, so I'm not going to use it. So instead of saying that someone's a stool pigeon, you could say he's a dirty rat. I'm kidding. Obviously, we don't want to use that derogatory name for someone who informs on someone else. So instead of stool pigeon or dirty rat or rat, what about just informant or snitch or whistleblower? So try those out instead. Now, you've most likely heard or used the phrase to quit something cold turkey. And this refers to addicts who are withdrawing from their cheese addiction. I mean, their drug addiction. Whatever, they're both the same. By 1830, the phrase, now follow this closely. There was a phrase by 1830 that says to talk cold turkey. to talk, because we hear this now still, we hear it to talk turkey, right? But the original phrase was to talk cold turkey. And it refers to someone who deals plainly and matter-of-factly with a subject. Because the idea is that a turkey's vocalization is very distinct. It's very clear. It's a very no-nonsense sound. And I've been meaning to record it for years. So in a way, this is kind of a positive one. To talk cold turkey was to refer to someone who spoke plainly. And so to quit cold turkey is derived from that idea. To quit cold turkey is to quit with no nonsense. It's just to quit overnight. And that's where the expression comes from. So I don't know. Is it a negative one? Is it a positive one? That's up to you. If you want a better expression to convey the meaning of speaking clearly and directly, how about to speak vegan? Because the whole idea is to use language that's direct and clear and truthful. But anyway, just a suggestion. There are more bird idioms, and I'm going to end with this one. And it's one that I'm not really sure merits an alternative, and that's to walk on eggs, you know, to tread carefully. Now, you can just say tread carefully to make your point, but I'm not sure that talking about walking on eggs is necessarily speciesist. Eggs are natural reproductive secretions of birds, and they're delicate little things because of what's inside of them. Now, I don't think the expression reflects any violence towards animals or even exploitation of animals. In fact, I think it bespeaks a lack of violence towards them because you're afraid of stepping on the eggs. You don't want to cause them harm. Now, if this is perhaps too positive a spin on the expression, then even a neutral characterization can be placed upon it. Because even if the egg is unfertilized and there's no life inside the egg, the idea is you just want to be careful of crushing the eggs because it would be messy if you step on them. So I'm going to consider this a neutral idiom, and I do plan on talking about some other neutral idioms in future episodes. But you could also say something like, you know, walking on thin ice. It's like walking on thin ice or walking on cherries or something like that. You get the idea. So returning to a particularly violent idiom and one that involves horses is the expression, "It's no use beating a dead horse." The original expression was most likely, "It's no use flogging a dead horse." And though the origin is based in British politics, the British politician and orator John Bright used it in a speech in 1867 in Parliament, it's a pretty morbid expression. Bright was trying to rouse Parliament from its apathy on a particular issue, and he said it was like trying to flog a dead horse to make it pull a load. Clearly, it means trying to revive interest in an apparently hopeless issue, and I think there are more compassionate ways to make the point. How about it's no use watering a dead flower, or it's no use washing a clean shirt, or something like that. Horses make their way into idioms quite a bit. Another expression we use a lot is never look a gift horse in the mouth, which I suppose would be a proverb, really. And there are many variations of this proverb in French, Italian, Spanish, and other European languages. Apparently, this expression is so old that its origins cannot be determined. It has been traced to the writings of Saint Jerome, one of the Latin fathers of the 4th century, who then, in the 4th century, labeled it as a common proverb. The expression refers to the bad manners of one who receives a gift but examines it for defects. Its reference to a horse's mouth comes from the fact that, up to a certain age at least, the age of a horse or a donkey can be determined by looking at his teeth. And though it may seem like an innocent expression, the fact that you need to check the horse's teeth means that you're checking the value of the horse. You're trying to determine his age and his worth because you intend to use the horse for some purpose. And so that's my point. I don't really like the use of it for that reason. So you can say something like, don't look for bugs in a flower bouquet. And not that there's anything wrong with bugs in a bouquet, but if you smell the bouquet, if you're smelling a bouquet of pretty flowers, you don't want to be bit in the nose by a bee or something like that. So I don't know. Don't look for bugs in a flower bouquet. If you have other ones, send them along. Another horse idiom is don't put the cart before the horse, which means don't reverse the accepted order of things. The first reference to this phrase in English comes in George Putnam's book, The Art of English Poetry, in 1589. Now, the phrase itself isn't necessarily as violent as, say, kill two birds with one stone, but it does refer to horses being used for our purposes. So we could say something like, don't put your shoes on before your socks. Don't slice the bread before it's baked. Any number of expressions you can make up yourself would do. Moving on from horses to cats, one particularly horrific expression is there's more than one way to skin a cat. Now, apparently, I don't know if this is true, but apparently the expression refers to a gymnastic move where you hang by the hands from a bar, your hands, you know, you hang from, you know, you're hanging on a bar with your hands, right? And then you draw your legs up through your arms over the bar, and then you pull yourself up into a sitting position. I don't know if it's true or not, but that's apparently what it was called. It was called skinning a cat, that move. It wasn't put in print until 1845, but it was most likely used before it was written down. Now, despite the fact that it refers potentially, allegedly, to a gymnastic position, I don't like it. I ain't gonna use it. I'd rather use a much less violent expression to communicate the fact that there's more than one way to do something. So how about there's more than one way to peel a potato? There's more than one way to peel a carrot. There's more than one way to squeeze a lemon. You know, something like that. I like that one. There's more than one way to squeeze a lemon. There's more than one way to peel a potato. Whatever works for you, I think, is much more compassionate than there's more than one way to skin a cat. When you let the cat out of the bag, you disclose a secret. Now, what I want to know is, what is the cat doing in the bag in the first place? And so on that point alone, I prefer to use a different expression, such as, you know, keep it under wraps, or keep it under your hat, or don't let the secret out of your hat, or don't let the secret out of the bag, or keep it secret. You could say the secret's out of the bag, something like that. The secret's been revealed. Clearly, there are better ways to express disclosing a secret. Now, the origin of the idiom is not certain, but there are two speculations. One is just as offensive as the idiom itself, and it refers to the supposed fraud of substituting a cat for a pig at markets where they're sold to someone who will kill them. So if you let the cat out of the bag, you reveal that you've put a cat in the bag instead of a pig. So you have a cat in the bag instead of a pig in the poke. That's where that expression comes from. A pig in a poke is a pig in a bag that you're bringing to market to sell for slaughter. The other speculation is that the cat referred to the cat of nine tails, which was supposedly brought out of a bag in order to flog sailors. But that one's less likely, and there isn't enough evidence to prove either theory, and the origin just remains uncertain. So we'll just start our own idiom and do away with that one altogether, so that someday it may just be obsolete. Okay. Furthering our cat theme, you may or may not have heard the expression, there's no room to swing a cat. But there you have it. It's a phrase that dates back to 1665 and may also refer to the cat of nine tails. The cat of nine tails was a kind of multi-tailed whip made of leather and used to implement punishment. It was used to whip sailors, especially in the Royal British Navy. Anyway, the idiom expresses the idea that you are in a confined space, that you have no room, which lends some plausibility to the theory that it refers to flogging a sailor in a small space, such as one that's on a ship. But nobody's sure of the true origin of the phrase. Still, either way, whether it's referring to actually swinging a cat or flogging a person, I don't like it, and I'm changing it. So how about there's no room to swing a bat? I don't know. That might be like we're talking about the animal, the bat. That one, right? No one's going to think of the... Okay. So how about there's no room to swing a chair? Or I don't know why anyone would swing a chair, but it provides the visual that you need to make your point. You could say there's no room to dance, or there's no room to tango, or, you know, whatever. You get the idea. So send me your suggestions. Come up with your own. Curiosity killed the cat. Now, this expression has some veracity behind it, because as anyone who lives with cats knows, they have been known to poke their noses where they don't belong, and they often learn the hard way, like most of us do, how to avoid dangerous situations. The exact phrase was coined by Eugene O'Neill in 1922, but I thought you'd appreciate some history of similar phrases. And from this little paragraph I'm going to read, you can weave your own alternative expression. So, in Wise Words and Wives' Tales by Stuart Flexner and Doris Flexner, there's a fun little paragraph about what they call the annoying tendency of some people to ask one question too many. Proverbial admonitions to the overly curious date back to ancient times, but curiosity killed the cat is apparently a recent invention. Of the earlier sayings, St. Augustine recorded in Confessions, the story of a curious soul who wondered what God did in the eons before creating heaven and earth. He fashioned hell for the inquisitive, came the stern reply, and proverbial sayings of more recent times have been no less forgiving.
British playwright Ben Jonson wrote in his 1598 play Every Man in His Humor, which incidentally was performed first by William Shakespeare, who, don't forget, was an actor before he was a writer, "Helter skelter, hang sorrow, care will kill a cat, up tails and all, and a pox on the hangman." Care will kill a cat is referring to curiosity will kill a cat. The 17th century saying, "He that prieth into every cloud may be struck with a thunderbolt," appeared in John Clark's book in 1639, and in the 19th century, Lord Byron in Don Juan roundly condemned the curious with, "I loathe that low vice, curiosity." An old expression, care, which is worry, you know, care killed the cat, dated from Shakespeare's time. But the connection between a cat and curiosity, however natural it may seem now, was not made until a reference to the current proverb appeared in 1909. The adaptation, "Curiosity can do more things than kill a cat," was recorded in O. Henry's short story, Schools and Schools, in 1909, and the exact wording of the proverb appeared later in Eugene O'Neill's Different in 1922. So our most current rendering of this proverb is really from 1922. But actually, this exact expression appeared as a headline in the Washington Post. It was really interesting to read in 1916 in an article that tells the very really sad story of a cat who climbed up the chimney, flew, and upon going higher and higher, he lost his footing and he fell and he died of a back injury. It's a really sad article, but I've heard even more horrific stories about cats getting into clothes dryers for real and the person not knowing their cat was in there when they turned on the dryer and getting into the refrigerator and things like that. So I didn't mean to descend into the morbid here, but if you live with cats, just check your clothes dryer, your refrigerator, and other places they could get hurt or killed before you proceed. So I don't know, because there's some veracity in this proverb, and because it's not necessarily violent towards cats, I think I'm going to let this one stay. So I'm going to leave this one as it is, because curiosity can indeed kill the cat. Could also kill the person. So I don't know. Curiosity killed the person. Curiosity killed the woman. I don't know. Some of the alternatives might not have the ring as the original idioms, but that's only because we've heard the originals again and again and again and again. If you have children, you know, you can start them on the new expressions, on the new compassionate expressions now, so that that's what becomes normal to them and it becomes normal in your household, and then they can start spreading it and it goes on and on and on and on. Okay, so just give them time. Give them time and certainly put them into practice so they become more comfortable to you. So that's it for now. There will be many more parts of this topic to follow. So speaking of just language and kind of our depictions of things, there are those bumper stickers and buttons you've seen out there that say, "Love animals, don't eat them." But I don't think that's something we can ask of people. You don't have to love animals in order not to eat them. You don't have to love them in order to want to protect them from harm. Many people who don't eat animals aren't necessarily quote-unquote animal lovers, though I think that's a terribly condescending way to talk about those of us who speak on behalf of animals. I say it's condescending because you know, it just makes it sound like we just like them because they're cute and furry and fuzzy, but it obviously goes much deeper than that. I don't think everyone has to be the kind of person who wants to spend time with animals. So I don't think asking people to love animals is reasonable or effective. But I do think it's reasonable to ask people not to eat them, because in doing so, it reflects that person's value not to want to create harm or to want to be kind or want to be compassionate or nonviolent. That's why I prefer the phrase, "Be kind to animals, don't eat them." Because most people would like to think of themselves as kind. My hope is that our language will begin to reflect the compassion we say we have for animals, and that our behavior will reflect those values of compassion and kindness. So have fun with these, because every time we open our mouths, we have the potential to speak for animals, we have the potential to reflect kindness and compassion, or we have the potential to reflect violence. So we have that choice every moment of every day, and my hope is that your language reflects your values of compassion, and that your behavior reflects your values of kindness. Be kind to animals. Don't eat them. This is Colleen with Compassionate Cooks. Thanks for listening.